to come in and set our salary low, even though theirs is high. So they'll be able to set it low because it won't hurt them.
Why can't we equally set our salary low?
Yeah, we could, except we won't.
Because
over there, they'll hire the person. And first of all, who wants to go to the meeting to talk about how to screw ourselves? Right? Are you going to go to it? Who's going to do it? I mean, who wants to do this? None of us want to do this. That's what people mean sometimes when they say, you know, I don't want to be involved in meetings. Well, if you really think about it, it's because their image of what a meeting is to make a decision, which is a crap decision. I don't want to be involved in the meeting either. But now ask workers in the workplace whether they want to be involved in a meeting on whether or not they should have a pool, or whether or not they should have a nice environment, right? Or whether they want to leave that decision to somebody else.
Was there a conscious dialogue?
Where's the meeting room, is what they're going to say. I'm ready to meet, right, to make that decision. What?
Was there a conscious dialogue about this in Yugoslavia where they were...
No, but now, Yugoslavia is real, right? So Yugoslavia comes out of capitalism. So you already have managers all over the place. You already have the mindset. You already have the workplace. So you just don't even bother changing. Right? You just get rid of the capitalists. But the coordinators are already in place, right? And you're already competing. And they're already demanding more for their whatever. And nobody has any idea of anything else. And in fact, the party, the political agencies of the change, like that. Why do they like that? Because that's who they are. Because they are the coordinator class. That's why they were for this in the first place. That's why they won this. You understand? So let's just clarify, and I'll give you a second. We do have more equity because we got rid of the capitalists. We don't have equity because we still have the coordinator class, which have better conditions and higher income. And we have that partly as a residue that's consistent with the institutional structure that we have, and we would even have it anyway because the institution breeds it, markets. Yes?
I understand everything you said, but I guess I was just kind of looking at the coordinate class. What exactly do they do? Now you're saying that you said it in a kind of a roundabout way, and I guess I kind of want a concise. Like,
well, the coordinator class has a relevant
group.
It's a class. Mm-hmm. So it's a sector of people in the economy defined by their role in the economy. And their role in the economy is that they have a relative monopoly on decision-making levers in day-to-day economic life, and on the knowledge and the skills and the dispositions and the time that is associated with making decisions. So they exist in our society. Lawyers, doctors, managers, stuff like that. And then they can become the new ruling class. See, historically in the debates and everything else among socialists, there's only two ruling classes, capitalists and workers. So if you don't have capitalism, you must have socialism. Lo and behold, the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia are called socialists.
And socialists feel that they need this class because why though?
Socialists don't, it's not a, that would be slightly the wrong way to say it. This class feels that it needs this class because they think they're brilliant and they can take care of everything and everybody else is an idiot.
Okay.
So that's why they think they need themselves in the top, right? And that's why they try to put themselves there. Now, working people may or may not have a different vision, which gives them the wherewithal to change things. In those past revolutions, they haven't had that different vision. They haven't had that wherewithal, and they have become subordinate to this new group. Participatory self-management, do we have that in market socialism?
No.
And why not?
Because we
have a coordinator class that specifically monopolizes the decision-making information, skills, not et cetera, et cetera. Of course we don't have participatory self-management. We have markets which make decisions in and of themselves, as we saw when we talked about in political economy, the time question and why we all work so long. For those, all right. Diversity, do we have more or less diversity? We got rid of one class. That's an, you could say that's less diversity. We got rid of something, right? But it also probably got rid of a lot of homogenizing pressures. Diversity is hard to judge in these cases, right? It's certainly not good. We know that, just like capitalism wasn't good. Whether it's bad, better or worse than capitalism is, I don't know. But it's not good. Okay, centrally planned socialism, i.e. the old Soviet Union, the old Soviet model. Solidarity. Is it socialism or is it coordinatorism? Why is there a commercial ringing in my head now? Is it or is it? I don't know. So, yeah. What? I'm going to have hard trouble concentrating now until I figure out what that is. What? What?
It's coordinator.
Why?
Coordinator.
Why?
It's centrally planned. There's a ruling class that makes the decision.
All right, but there's these planners, right? But it's more than that. Suppose that we're the planners, okay? So what do we have that other people don't have?
Power.
But aside from that, what legitimates it?
Credentials.
Knowledge, right? And credentials. The knowledge isn't particularly relevant because, you know, but we have to have something so that we can legitimate it, so we have credentials. We have credentials because I sure as hell don't want any of them ragamuffins testing me, right? So I have credentials. So we have credentials, we have knowledge, we have particular skills, we have particular disposition. And now we're all sitting here and we're going to plan the economy. So we're planning the economy, willy-nilly, and we've got a plan that we want the factory out there to do. How do we get the factory out there to do the plan? So what do we do? Do we call them up and say, do it, and then hang up, and then expect them to go do it?
Someone goes over there and instructs them.
We got somebody over there who we talk with. Do we want to? Why can't we have the workers' council? So we talk with all the workers over there. What's wrong with that?
They don't want to go to the meetings, so they're not going to do it.
Well, they don't. We're telling them to do all this shit that might be different than what they want to do. And now we're going to have to negotiate with them and argue with them and everything else. So who do we prefer to talk to?
Coordinator.
Yeah, we prefer to talk to one of us. We prefer to have some of us over there who are managing that firm. And managing it how? In accord with what we plan. Why? Because they're like us. Because they have the same interests we do. Because they get ahead the same way we do. Because when we make a plan and it aggrandizes us more than everybody else, it aggrandizes them more than everybody else too. And so they get the benefits of it. And we negotiate with them, which is easier. And they do the local. It's not that different than capitalism hiring managers. In other words, the capitalist starts out a long time ago with small firms, and the capitalist runs the whole show. As the firm gets bigger, the capitalist can't run the whole show and now has to have managers. It's not that different. So, centrally planned socialism or centrally planned coordinatorism has a coordinator class as a ruling class. So does it have solidarity? Well, there's no solidarity between the planners and the workers. There's no solidarity. Does it have less or more solidarity than market socialism?
More.
See, this has to be theory at work because you got no fucking idea, right? You certainly have no experience of it, so it isn't experience that's going to give it. You're making predictions now.
So if
right?
We don't have markets, what do they have?
They have central planning. Oh, so central planning is we sit around and we say, this should be the inputs of that firm, this should be the outputs, this should be the inputs of the next firm, this should be the outputs, et cetera, et cetera. Here's where people should work in such and such numbers, et cetera, et cetera. We create a plan. How do we do it? We get information from throughout the economy, we massage and manipulate the information, and we create a plan. Then we send the plan back out, and we say, this is what we want you to do to all the firms. Actually, we say it to our coordinator buddies in the firms. The coordinator buddies in the firms look at it and try to figure out whether or not they can do it, and to tell us back whether or not they can do it. We then take that information, massage it around, send out orders, and they obey. That's what central planning is.
So it's not supply and demand,
Supply, it's not like a market, it's not competition. Supply and demand still operates. That is to say, we do not want to say produce 10,000 widgets, consume 3,000 widgets, right? So it's markets, is the issue isn't really supply and demand, it's competition.
Okay,
widgets
competition.
Is a technical economics term. I kid you not. Widgets is basically that's the word that the economists use for the, you know, abstract product, widgets. So it just slipped out. So we don't tell them to produce, you know, 400,000 gallons of Bud Light when people are only going to drink 200,000 gallons of it, or none of it. All right. In a good society, would anybody do that? I mean, I don't want to get into micro predicting, but all right. So we're comparing centrally planned social coordinatorism, we might as well call it by its real, and market coordinatorism, and we're asking which one has more or less solidarity. Can we pick that? I think we can.
Central planning, probably.
Has more solidarity.
Yeah.
Why?
Because
Because you've got classes in both, and at least there you don't have markets, so only one.
At least there you don't have markets. In other words, again, if all you have to do, we said that markets were this very powerful force against solidarity. And we got rid of markets. It's just like, was market socialism or capitalism more equitable? We can answer that question. We got rid of capitalists. We got rid of this gigantic cause of inequality. It's more equitable. It's not equitable. It's not something that we aspire to as the be-all and end-all, but it's a vast improvement. Central planning, by and large, is going to have different qualities and characteristics than market system, even though they both have the same ruling coordinator class.
Why would they choose a market system over the central plan?
Well, freedom. You know, they thought they were getting a more libertarian. Right now in the United States, among socialists, most people are market socialists.
Okay.
Right? And why are they market socialists? Well, they look at central planning and they say it's authoritarian. And they fear Stalin. Right? It's authoritarian. So they're trying to, you're saying, why would they stick with the markets with all the ills? They're saying, I don't want the central planning with all of its ills, the authoritarianism, right? And that's perfectly understandable. I agree with them. I don't want the authoritarianism either, but I don't want markets either, right? So I, you know, like an intelligent three-year-old, want another choice. Okay, so market socialism, less solidarity than centrally planned, but both of them, potsy.
I'm sort of confused. With a centrally planned socialism, how do they distribute the goods?
Through, see, a market isn't a store. Mm-hmm. Store. So, in other words, if the plan says that Woods Hole should have so and so much food, mm-hmm. the trucks come in with the food and it goes on the shelves. How do we get it? We buy it. But that doesn't mean it's a market. Why? Because the price, the exchange rate that we're paying for it, wasn't set by competition. It was set by a plan. It's very different.
So why did they have so much trouble getting food and stuff in the Soviet
Why what?
Had so much trouble getting food and stuff in the Soviet Union. Like
well, one of the things is, suppose that the price of a house in the United States right now, tomorrow, becomes 1/5, let's make it 1/10 of your income, no matter what your income is, no matter what the house is, right? So if you go shopping for a house, the one that you see, that's what it costs, 1/10 your income. Right? What's the line for houses? We call it the queue. What's the queue? How many people are lining up to buy a house? What? It's a big line, right? And there aren't enough houses. That's why. If you have some social values, and centrally planned socialist economies generally had some, in fact, social values, they were horrible things, but they had some values. So, for instance, they set the price of milk, they set it way down. They set the price of housing, they set it down. They set the price of ice cream, they set it down. They set the price of heat, they set the price of medicine, they set it all the way rock bottom, you know. So you set the price really, really low, and all of a sudden everybody's lining up, right? Now, what are you doing when you start to raise the price up? You simply, are you changing the number of people who want the thing? No. Are you changing the number of people who express their want for the thing? Yes, the minute the price is above what you can afford, you stop expressing your desire for it. You see what's going on here? So queues weren't really such a bad thing. Queues, those long lines, are basically saying, look, it's a matter of luck whether or not you get it or you don't, instead of giving it only to an elite. We don't have enough yet? Okay, we'll give it out. And right? Now, it turned out that if you were in the party, you could get to the front of the line. So it wasn't all that perfect. But that's what's going on. Right? Now, the other thing that's going on is that the Soviet Union in 1917 was a third world country. The United States had 200 years of development. Comparing the United States to the Soviet Union in 1990 is insane. Right? The right comparison is the Soviet Union and Brazil. Not the Soviet Union and the United States. The fact that the Soviet Union could be compared to the United States is a miracle, right? See what I'm saying? But it's all confused in the public mind. Now, if you compare the Soviet Union in 1990 when it changed to Brazil in 1990, the Soviet Union is a dungeon for me. But it comes off pretty good, right? Not so bad in terms of productive output and everything else. All right, but. Now we get to participatory self-management. Does market socialism have that? We said no. Why? Because we said there was a coordinator class and it had a monopoly on those kinds of things inside the workplace, right? But what about central planning? Does that have participatory self-management?
No.
No. Well, again, it has the coordinator class, so it has the same. Is it worse or better? It's worse. Why is it worse? Because central planning is the most explicit authoritarian structure you can come up with. You simply separate the elite off. You know, it's not just in the unit, but it's for the whole economy. You set the thing off, and it's orders going down and orders being implemented. At least in Marxists, there's some notion of some kind of freedom and autonomy. This is why people like the markets, and they ignore all the problems, right? But I honestly think that, indeed, the old Soviet Union was more regimented than the old Yugoslavia. And it's built into the institutions. There's a difference there. Now, is it a fundamental difference? No, they're both coordinator economies. One's central plan, one's market. But you see how institutions have these implications. Right? That's the point.
Did you say that equity was the same between the two of them, central plan and market?
Actually, you know, I don't know. My guess would be... So, you see, I cheat on all the other questions. I'm asking you to predict, and I know, because I know the evidence. So I'm cheating. But on that one, I don't know. But my guess is that the income difference... The Soviet Union is a bad example. If we took Cuba and Yugoslavia, I'll bet the income, the spread of incomes is better in Cuba. Much better. In other words, the central... See, Cuba's a peculiar case. Cuba's a case that's not supposed to exist. That is to say, you know, authority corrupts, absolute authority corrupts absolutely, whatever, that's the right? Yeah, that's the quote. Why? It's all well and good to be able to say a quote like that, but why? Why does authority corrupt, and why does absolute authority corrupt absolutely?
Because nobody calls you anything you do,
basically. That's one factor. That's one factor. But if I have authority, what do I have to do? I have to look in the mirror. So I have to have an explanation for why I have authority. So when I have authority that isn't appropriate, that is, when I have more decision-making input than the influence on me, right, or more decision-making influence than the impact on me, disproportionate, that's basically what it means. When I have more of that than I should, more authority than I should, right, I have to have a justification for it. What's my justification likely to be?
Smarter.
I'm smarter, and they're stupider. And I'm on the road to corruption. Pretty soon, I'm a human, they are chattel. I can steal, I can do whatever I want. I think that's what it is. You might not buy it, but that's what I think it is. In other words, it's an empirical observation. Authority corrupts, absolute authority corrupts absolutely. Well, I want to explain the empirical observation. Why should it be the case? That's my explanation. Okay, so back to... I completely forget what the hell we were doing.
Cuba.
Oh, the oddity about Cuba is that... You know, I guess it's a centrally planned economy, a centrally planned coordinator economy with a dictatorial state. And nonetheless, it is, while it's not my idea of the thing that I want to, you know, fight for and win, it is so vastly superior to anything that you can compare it to that was at a comparable position when it started, despite the fact that for 30 years we've been waging a war of terrorism and you know, isolation against it, that it is mind-boggling, and that is in large part due to the fact that the people who made that revolution, unlike the people who made the Russian Revolution, seem to have much more staying power against the process of becoming schmucks, you know, becoming elitist schmucks, enriching themselves. Castro is quite a phenomenal figure in history, right? He, in many respects, in that sense, they have warded off the corrupting dynamics, the authoritarian dynamics. It still is. It's not my idea of the ideal society. But if you want to make an accurate comparison, you have to compare Cuba to Guatemala and ask what Guatemala would be like with an embargo for 30 years. Not to mention, you know how there's supposed to be all this world terrorism, right? Terrorism all over the world. Well, here's all the terrorism in the world in the last 35 years. And here's all the terrorism conducted by the United States against Cuba. We'll just move that part over to here. Well, all the terrorism conducted by the United States against Cuba is approximately the same height as all the terrorism in the whole rest of the world conducted by anybody. It's a little friggin' island, right? And meanwhile, now let's compare this island to Guatemala. Well, you'd have to be a lunatic to think that if you're going to be randomly placed in Cuba or Guatemala, you'd rather be in Guatemala. You'd rather be in Cuba. I mean, you might rather be the ruling class in Guatemala, right? But in other words, but really, what you have to compare it to, unbelievably, is Kansas. Right? To have any kind of a comparison. And when you do that, healthcare is better in Cuba, education is better than Cuba, literacy is better in Cuba, you know, the situation of newborn kids and mothers is better in Cuba, and on and on and on. You know, some things are worse, to be sure, you know, but pretty amazing. So, centrally planned socialist economy, I'm not it for it, right? But let's not get confused. Just because we're not for it, we shouldn't then say, well, it's a piece of shit, right? And we should be able to see what things really are. It really does get rid of capital. It really does institute an economic system which can decide to lower the price of housing, right? And to do other things like that on humane grounds. But it is intrinsically authoritarian. That's ultimately why you have to reject it. It does not provide participatory self-management. And it's class divided. And maybe if you have unbelievable historical process, you can keep the class that's in power looking out for the other class. It's like a paternalistic kind of dynamic, which is better than smash them. I mean, I'd rather have a nice paternalistic ruler than somebody smashing me. Okay, is this, are people, anybody got a problem? Question, yeah.
What happened with the capitalists anyways? Where did they...
Sorry, what?
When they got rid of the capitalist component of it,
yeah.
They had the manager class that was already there. Where did the capitalists go?
In Cuba? Or in Cuba, they went to Florida. Really? I mean, you know, they went to Florida. That's who they went to. They went to the U.S. So did lots of coordinators. Why? Because the Cuban Revolution was very, very egalitarian. And all the rhetoric and everything was... They were anti-communist, the Cubans. I mean, people don't understand that. But the Cuban Revolution, you read Che and Fidel and people like that, and they just ridiculed the shit out of the Russians. But the United States did what? Well, it's very important to have that. That was a disaster, right? What the Cubans really wanted to do was really a disaster, because that would really be good. So the United States had to isolate them, embargo them, and everything else, so as to produce the ties that the Cuban didn't want. The Cubans would rather have ties to the U.S. than Russia at the outset, right? Get them into the Russian camp. Get the Russian model imposed. Get it to be less desirable.
So how were they different?
History isn't always all just institutions. It's sometimes people, right? I mean, they were just different, you know. There's something about the heritage, whatever you want. Che Guevara is not Lenin, you know. Fidel is not, you know. What and likewise others, and it's I don't know. Yeah.
Excuse me. Have you been to Cuba at all?
Yeah.
I'm just curious.
Yes.
I've never been there, but.
Yes. Yes.
I guess I have two conflicting views in my mind.
I'm not sure it matters.
Oh, I know.
Right. I mean, in other words, you know, people think you go someplace, you learn all about it, and you're an expert on it. Well, you know, you can actually sit in a room and read books and become more of an expert in all likelihood. Right? So you do get something. And you get some things that you can't get in the books, especially if the people writing the books are warped. Mm-hmm. So that's a good reason to go to Cuba, right? But there's a mistake to think that, you know, 2 weeks in such and such a place makes one an expert. Rarely. Yeah.
I guess for Cuba, I've got two conflicting views in my mind. One where Che Guevara and Fidel Castro were honest libertarian revolutionaries,
right,
who realized that if they do the, well, a bad example, but the Allende thing of trying to do progression while not running a tight boat, they're dead because they're going to be infiltrated and killed. And then another one where they are just benevolent authoritarians. I was just wondering which you think, and maybe that...
All of it.
Okay.
All of the above. But Che isn't a good example. Che is somebody who made a revolution, was God, right, in his country. Just God. I mean, four steps above Fidel. And what did he do?
Olivia to die.
He just took off to die. Right? He decided, I'm going to try and do it again someplace else. So that's amazing. Who else in history? Emiliano Zapata. Same thing. Not very many people. Right? Not very many people who make a revolution, attain the heights of society, can run the society, are absolutely loved by every single human being in Cuba, right, and all over Central America. And what does he decide to do? Go out into the jungle again. Anyway, so what do we have? We have four values. And we need one more. And the one more that we need is that the economy has to actually produce the stuff that's going to fulfill people. It has to meet people's needs. And we use a value there that people aren't going to want to use. What's the word that we use? Along with filling people's needs. We want to fill people's needs and not do something else.
Command desire?
Not waste stuff. And what's the word for that?
Efficiency.
Yeah. And we want efficiency. I want efficiency. Why do we want efficiency? Let's suppose we're sitting around here and we're deciding that we want to plant a garden out in the back. Do we want to be efficient when we go and plant the garden? Yes, because efficiency, what it means is no waste. And if we decide, if we value things properly, now no waste doesn't mean, so we don't want to waste time, let's say. Because we value time, right? We don't want to waste time. But that doesn't mean we want to go out there with somebody holding a machine gun at us making us work quickly. Because we also value other things. Now, if the only thing we value is time, then that's what we want to do, right? Go out there and work like maniacs. But we value lots of things. So efficiency is in context of all the things you value, not wasting things that you care about. That's all it is. It is not a pejorative term. It becomes a pejorative term the minute that you value things in a ridiculous fashion. The only thing you value is profit and power, right? And then nothing else matters. So it's perfectly okay to work people to death out there, and that's efficient. Why? Because the only thing that we wasted was them. Right? We wasted them as human beings, but that doesn't matter because that's not in our calculation. So it's efficient for the capitalist efficiency, and our efficiency is not the same thing. But we don't want to create an economy which is wasteful. There's another economic system that I want to address because some people feel that it's a, you know, it's another one on the agenda. And if there's one out there that we can adopt, we should before we go worrying about thinking up a new one. That's bioregionalism. Has anybody heard about that? Good, okay. Are you a, sort of an advocate or
just
a little? Okay. A lot of greens and people who are into ecology, thinking about stuff, begin to say, well, maybe this is what we should have, and they call it bioregionalism. Okay? What is it? Well, it's a little bit hard to pin down because nobody really says. But basically what they're saying, I think, is we want workplaces, and it would be nice if the workplaces, I mean, probably most of them would say it would be nice if the workplaces had exactly the qualities that we're going to say we want in workplaces, so balanced job complexes, so on and so forth. And then they say they want, they'd like people to sort of interact together, but really what they want to be sure of is that every little region is self-sufficient. Somehow they come to the conclusion, so bioregionalism, that you define a biologically defined region, a sort of ecologically defined region, by looking at somehow the natural environment or something, and you find this region, and that region should be self-sufficient, right? You shouldn't be trucking stuff in and trucking stuff out and so on and so forth. Now, does this make any sense at all?
No.
There's a prior question to that, which is sort of, why do greens come up with this? And I must admit, this is the part that completely befuddles me. What, if there's one thing that ecology teaches us that maybe we didn't know before, what is it?
It's the interaction of systems globally?
It's that everything is entwined. Everything depends on everything else. That's exactly what an ecological mindset is. Everything is intrinsically and interconnected and entwined. And in ecology, you'd think that an ecological impetus, an ecological dynamic, an ecological sort of mindset and orientation would be to respect, enhance, you know, take into account what is inevitable, that everything is entwined. And then along comes this product of the green movement, which says, let's cut ourselves into regions and make each one, you know, independent, autonomous, and self-sufficient. It's insane. Right? It's exactly the opposite of what you would think would come out of an ecological mindset, which is everything is interdependent and intertwined, and we have to deal with it. I don't understand that. I've posed that to lots of greens, and sometimes when I pose it to them, they say, uh-oh. and they really begin to wonder what the hell happened in there. And other times they just are, you know, I don't know. I've never been able to get answers there. But the question is, does it make any sense? So suppose we have a desert, and that's a bioregion. And suppose over here we have a place with a lot of resources. What's going to happen if we have bioregionalism?
Poor and miserable.
Poor and miserable and rich and well off, right? And what's the, and so you say that to the bioregionalists, and they say, oh no, fucking A, of course we're not assholes like that. And they're not. They're very good people, and they have very good values and desires. So they say, well, we don't mean anything like that. Of course we'll have to do something about that. So you say to them, well, what are you going to do about that? But the only thing you can do about that is truck the stuff. Right? You have to do the opposite of what bioregionalism says. You have to have, we'll call it trade for a minute. You have to have some kind of exchange. Well, now you have to have an allocation institution. And now the problem is that the bioregionalists don't say anything about what the allocation institution is. So we're back to markets and the whole thing is a piece of junk.
See, I don't know where you heard of that from, because I'm looking at the Green Party platform and the 10 key values and all that stuff.
Not everybody.
I've never read anything about that.
Yeah, not everybody. No, not everybody. I don't want to... Some greens. Remember I said some greens. Bioregionalism is a tendency and a trend. Here's another one. Small is beautiful. Right? We should decrease scale. First of all, why do people move in the direction of bioregionalism? Well, there's a good reason. Suppose you put 14 million people in a little 17-acre plot. Well, now you've got to truck in food from all over captivity. So you've got to do the work that's associated with moving all the food. Right? Now, spread out the 14 million people to where the food is. Now you don't have to do all the work that's associated with moving it. Well, that's a big savings of time and energy and labor. And it also is a savings of oil and pollution and everything else. So there's an impetus here that's right, right? But then there's an impetus that's wrong. So that it's like technology. You know, technology sucks because technology spews garbage and everything else. Well, fine. You don't get rid of all technology. You get rid of bad technology. You know, you have to think two steps instead of one step. You got to think... Some technology is bad. Why is the technology bad? Let's get rid of the part that's the why. So some centralization and interconnection is bad, right? So let's get rid of that. But not every bit of interconnection. That makes no sense at all. So small. Why do people advocate small? Well, because they see big firms and they see a lot of pollution, and so they say small's better, or at least I hope it's better. We got to do better than that. You know, we got to think a little harder than that. First of all, is it true? Is it true, just from the point of view of ecology, that moving from large workplace to small workplace is inexorably less damaging to the ecology? In other words, in every instance. Well, here's what is true. The large workplace, the small workplace. It is true that the large workplace will inevitably do more damage to the ecology than this little tiny one. But it is probably not always true that the large workplace will do more damage to the economy than 40,000 of these little tiny ones. That's the second step in the thinking. Right? So in other words, let's say we want to do bicycles. Is it true that ecological damage will be less, just ecological damage, forget even you know, human labor. Ecological damage will be less if we have a big place which produces lots of bicycles, or if we have a little place and we ship them, or we have little places that produce a relatively few bicycles for smaller regions. Well, you don't know the answer in advance. You have to look at the technology, you have to look at the processes, you have to look at the resources, right? You have to look at all sorts of things. Even the shipping answer isn't obvious. Okay, the big place has to ship the bicycles to every place, but every place has to ship the steel to the big place. So if the steel's all the way out here, you got to ship it here, right? If you put the bicycle plant next to the steel, you don't have to ship the steel at all. Now suppose you got the little bicycle plants all over the country. You got to ship the steel all over the country instead of the bicycles all over the country. There's no thinking involved, right? Now it could be that the little plants are better than the big one because you can use the technology in the little ones that doesn't spew any stuff and that isn't labor, right? But it could also be that the economies of scale not only save labor but save the ecology. What you need is an economy that will make the proper choice. Same thing with the trucking, with the decentral and the... You need an economy which will choose properly, because there is no single right answer. The problem with small is beautiful or bioregionalism is it thinks there's a right answer. Not that it hasn't identified something you have to worry about. You have to worry about it, but there is no one answer. Yeah.
That's what I asked. Do you think maybe they think that partially because of like the bigger... organizations or bigger companies might have a disproportionate amount of influence or power, so they ecologically could get away with that, like bypassing certain laws?
Okay, except the reverse holds too, because the little one only has to get away with a little bit summed over all of them, right? You see, again, you need a second step. But we're not then talking about a new economy either. As soon as we talk about a new economy, we have to ask whether that's really true. Is the size of the firm have anything at all to do with whether or not it'll, you know, it has more or less power? The answer is no. We'll see. What do we know about power if we do our job right? How much power is anything going to have? How much influence is anything going to have? Proportionate to the effect on it. If we do our job right, right, what's going to be the case regarding pollution? The people who are affected by it are going to have influence over the decision that would yield the pollution. not just the people who are in the firm, but the people who are affected by the pollution. That's which doesn't happen now. Markets don't do that. We have to have an economy which does that. Is that clear? I mean, what we want to do is pretty weird. What we want to do is we want to create an economy in which A, production, consumption, what we do in work, what we do when we consume, makes us care about each other. It isn't just that we're allowed to be good, which would already be a big innovation, right? But it literally makes us care about each other. We want an economy which properly values everything, right? Which doesn't misvalue everything the way markets do. Remember, we talked about externalities, and markets only can take into account the buyer and seller, but we want, if it's a car, we want the person who might breathe the fumes to be involved in the transaction somehow. It starts to seem a bit daunting, right? We want every transaction that affects people to, for people to be able to influence. It's a bit daunting. We also want the information that's necessary to be able to do it sensibly to be available to people, right? And we don't want classes. And we want... We want remuneration for effort and sacrifice. And we have to figure out institutions that can accomplish all of that. This is where the other class got to. We got to it a little earlier. I don't think I want to go further, because then when the class is mush, we'll be out of whack. So does somebody have anything they want to ask at this point? The next time what we're going to do is the workplace, the structure of work, payment, etc. And then the next thing we'll do is allocation and participatory planning. And in the third thing. I just do want to say one thing. I guess I should probably say one thing. Unlike the other things that we've been talking about, at least in classes with me, people do have a lot of knowledge of the other things. People don't have a lot of knowledge of an alternative economy. Imagine somebody sitting around trying to explain capitalism under feudalism and do it an hour and a half, or, you know, 4.5 hours, whatever. I'm not going to convince you of participatory economics, much less get you to a position where, if you like it, you could go out and argue it. You know, what I'm hoping is, A, the procedures that we're using to think about it. You know, if you replicate what we did today for kinship, right? In other words, suppose we want to have a kinship vision, right? A vision for how to do the family, how to do procreation, how to do socialization. Suppose we want a vision for what we should do about culture, religion, right? Ethnic identity, racial identity, celebration. Suppose we want to have one for what we want to do about the state, about how we adjudicate disputes, how we legislate norms and laws, how we enforce, etc. Suppose we want to do these things. Well, we follow the exact same trajectory we're following. So the main thing I want to get across is get rid of the fear of thinking about vision. See, the one place that I disagree with Ryan last night, remember when he said we have the best vision? That's a crock of shit. We don't have any vision. What he meant by we have the best vision is we have the best values. Right? We can enunciate values. And he also meant we have the best sort of aims. We aim for justice. We aim for an end to, you know, exploitation. We aim for an end to poverty. But that's not a vision. And I don't know whether he knows that or not, but most of the left has no idea what the rest of the country knows, which is that values, Bill Clinton spouts values, right? Hell, Bush spouts values, right? Why don't we believe them? Well, because we think that there's a gap between the substance of his institutional desires and the values. When the left spouts values without institutions, there's no reason to believe us. And that's why when we list, we want solidarity, we want this, we want that, we want the other thing, and we talk to a normal person, they're saying, yeah, but you probably also want starvation. And then what do? Well, we come up with bioregionalism, right? And we say to them, well, we want to cut everything into a little thing and not have intertwinement. We feed all the fears, right? That's insane. That is basically saying to them, you critics of the left are right, right? Or we say we don't want technology. Because the real reason to reject the left is, and this is what normal people reject the left for. I mean, the average working person doesn't reject the left because they're protecting Bill Gates. They reject the left because they're thinking to themselves, these maniacs are going to create an economy in which there's nothing. There's nothing to consume. It's worse, not better. Why do they think that? Because they think that in our pursuit of self-management and equity and diversity and solidarity, we will be like Pol Pot, right? So in other words, we'll discover that it's not a good idea to have 14 million people in Los Angeles, and we'll just march everybody out on a death march, Right? In other words, that's one reason. And the second reason is because, which some people on the left probably would be prompt to do. And the second reason is because they think that we will forego industry, we'll forego technology, we'll forego science, we'll forego everything in pursuit of our equity. And we run around saying that. We run around saying we don't like technology, right? We don't like science. We don't like, you know, and we feed the justifiable reason to reject us. What we should be saying is, we like products, we like goods, we want things that will make people's lives better. We just want to do it with less torturous labor, more justly, with fairer distribution of the outcomes, and with people controlling their own lives and dignity. And we want science, and we want technology. It's just that we want science and technology that serve people instead of oppress people, and so on and so forth. But instead, we run around with those other views. Or small is beautiful. I mean, people are smart. You know, normal working people are smart, and they just laugh at the shit that we say. Or they just sort of chuckle and turn away and stuff. So we have to have a... So when I say that the place that I disagree with Ron is about the vision, he puts forward the values, but I didn't hear the vision. And the vision isn't put forward, and in the absence of vision, the values are not convincing. See, suppose white guys got up and said, I'm against racism, right? Without the substance, Ron doesn't believe them, rightly. And it's the exact same thing. So the black community doesn't believe when the white leftists get up and say, I'm against racism, I'm against racism, and I'm going to keep all the money that I got because of white skin privilege in my movement. So the anti-war movement will have 47,000 times the assets. Or, right now, I'm against racism, I'm against racism, the New Party says, the Green Party says, the et cetera. And Ron's party, you know, the black effort to make a party, has no money. And the others have all the money. Right? Well, they're all against racism, but they're not going to share any of those assets that they get simply because they're white and he's black. But why should he trust that they're serious when they say that? There's no substance behind it. So we need substance. So vision is institutions. It isn't, you know, we're doing values so far, but without the institutions, it's a crock. So we have to add the institutions. Okay.
I've actually got an unrelated question, kind of. Do you see any difference between what you're saying and consistently applied anarchism?
What do you mean? You mean, do I? No, I think that participatory economics, the economic vision, is an economic vision that anybody who is actually a sensible anarchist, a sincere, caring, thinking anarchist, should adopt.
But I don't even mean just that, but in terms of your, I don't know what you want to call it, spheristic holism or whatever, right?
Yes,
but
I do think there's a difference there. The difference is that I think that historically, I mean, if anarchists want to call themselves anarchists and adopt all that, okay, you know. But anarchists historically is about power and about the state and about the government firstly. Right. That's the main.
But
it's certainly
okay.
Not
so
about gender,
not
and it's certainly not about
but
race.
You're saying it's not consistently applied now.
No, I'm saying, look, it's the same as Marxism. Suppose I said about Marxism, it isn't about gender, it isn't about sex, it isn't about, it's about class. It's not that they didn't consistently.
Well, but that's true. But if you ask an American to say, "What are your values?" They'll all be, "I'm against illegitimate hierarchy," right?
Yeah, but
so what you can say is, in patriarchy.
If you want to,
okay.
Okay,
but it's all, I guess it's semantic.
Okay.
Yes. I mean, I think all.
Okay.
And then after that, you want to use it again tomorrow or whatever. And then possibly for the evening lectures, I might share.
That's fine. I'm just like using it like, you know, during my free time at night.
Oh, yeah, that's
like
fine. So every night after the lectures, I can just give this back to you. You can use it, you know. And then just before the evening lectures, I need it back. That's all. So we can just kind of work back and forth with each other every day.
My batteries die at like at 40 minutes or something, 50 or so.
Oh, just now?
Yeah.
So don't you have an AC adapter?
No. I'm thinking about going out and getting one.
Yeah. Just made a Rodeo Shack run.
I know, I just saw that. Did you get stuff?
I got some tapes, actually. I should grab that right now before I forget.